You're listening to Equipping Pastors with Ken Whitten, a podcast powered by the North American Mission Board. Here you will find conversations to help you engage with other pastors, equip you for the everyday grind of ministry, and encourage you to live out your calling with confidence. To find out more about the podcast or resources for pastors, visit EquippingPastorsPodcast.com.
Well, welcome to the Equipping Pastors Podcast, and I'm your host, Ken Whitten. Hey, Pastor, whether you are thriving or just surviving to hang on, let me tell you what this podcast and the purpose for it is. We want to provide helpful conversations to you that will do three things. We want to engage you with other pastors. We want to equip you for the everyday grind of ministry. And of course, we want to encourage you to live out your calling with confidence. I want you to know that I am so excited and so stoked to have our podcast guest with us today. His name is Jared Wilson. And for many of you, he needs no introduction. But for some of you, let me just tell you, he is the assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. He's the pastor of preaching and director of Pastoral Training Center at Liberty Baptist Church. And he's the author of numerous books, including The Gospel-Driven Church, The Gospel-Driven Ministry, and The Prodigal Church. He hosts the For the Church podcast. He's the co-host of the Art of Pastoring podcast. And we are really excited, Jared Wilson, to have you on this podcast today. Thank you for coming.
Brother, thanks so much for having me. I'm glad we could finally get it to work out. It felt like we were playing phone tag for a long, long time.
Well, we were. Well, if you want somebody to do something, you just ask busy people, because they're busy doing those kind of things. Hey, so let me just ask, and maybe for myself, maybe even for the readers, you have written these books, Gospel-Driven Church, Driven Ministry, Prodigal Church. Which book did you write first?
Yeah, the Prodigal Church book came first.
Okay.
And there's kind of a natural progression from that. So that book was largely a critique of sort of the attractional movement. The subtitle is A Gentle Manifesto Against the Status Quo. So I tried to write the critique from a kind and pastoral way. I think a lot of us are used to critiques that are either angry or unkind or ungentle. And I thought, well, that doesn't get anyone to, you know, to listen in. So I kind of wrote that book as just sort of the idea was like sitting across the table from somebody over coffee and just me trying to say, hey, think about this or consider it from this angle. But, you know, even with that approach, and there was one chapter in that book that kind of outlined maybe an alternative or a way forward. So that gave rise to the idea behind the Gospel-Driven Church, which was to say, okay, critique by itself is not enough. You actually have to construct something and give someone a positive vision. And so the Gospel-Driven Church has some critique in it, but it is largely a, how do we apply this gospel-centered thing in a practical way that actually deals with what people are dealing with in their churches?
Right, right. And then, of course, then your latest book is the great book of the Gospel-Driven Church, correct?
Gospel-Driven Ministry came after Gospel-Driven Church. And okay. Gospel-Driven Ministry is really, it's sort of an introduction to pastoral ministry. So okay. it's not, you know, there are elements of the kind of attractional gospel-centered, you know, dichotomy in there, but it's mainly from the qualifications through preaching to ministering to those who are suffering to counseling. It's kind of a primer on, sure, on pastoral ministry itself.
Well, in the Gospel-Driven Church, and I took all of our pastors through it at Idlewild, of course, before I became involved with North American Mission Board on a full-time status. But our pastors all had this same question. It's a question I've been dying to ask you, and I think our readers probably would like to ask you too. You introduce us to a church, and that church is called Life Point. And yeah. Let's just start this podcast and just put it right out there. Is that a real church or is that a fictional church to fit the narrative of the example that you want to give us of what it looks like to be a gospel-driven church? Come on.
Yeah. Well, it's a fictitious example built on real life anecdotes, either from my own experience or the experience of those that I have heard from or coached or
right?
Preached at their churches. So it's kind of a composite. I use the name LifePoint because it's a pretty common church name, and of course, I have friends who pastor churches that are actually called LifePoint, and I have to make it clear, like, I'm not writing about your church. This is just the generic name.
And you probably
name.
Should have just put the disclaimer on there that names have been concealed to protect the guilty.
That's right.
You know, so let's start off. Let's start this way today. And in case you're listening today and you have not read The Gospel Driven Church, I hope you hear a 5-star coming from this pastor, Ken Whitten, to you. And I don't want to give you a spoiler alert here, but Jared, let me just ask you, would you just first describe to us LifePoint Church as you begin to write and what you begin to try to say to us? What does LifePoint Church look like?
Yeah, LifePoint Church is a church that is in transition. It's a church that began with a zeal for reaching the lost, based on not just my experience, but the experience of others that I have known, friends that I've had in ministry who planted a church in the mid-80s to the early 90s, and the desire was to plant a church for the unchurched. And sometimes, you know, friends are planting together. And so the story in the gospel-driven church pictures a couple of friends who plant this church together and over time discover, as the years go by, that their vision for the church is beginning to change somewhat. And when we pick up the story in the quote-unquote present day, one of those friends is the last pastor sort of remaining, and he's now the head, the lead pastor of the church, and he has undergone sort of a transformation of his ministry philosophy towards a more gospel-centered approach, which is somewhat disorienting for him. And as he begins to look at how do I now lead this church or transition this church more aligned with that vision, is very jarring or disorienting for his support staff and for other pastors who have been with the church for a long time or who, you know, bought into the previous ministry philosophy and to the church in general. So the ongoing story of the book is how does the lead pastor, number one, cast vision in a way that pastors people into this transition rather than pushing them or, you know, arguing them or just bulldozing his way through. And then how do the people in the youth, you know, the youth pastor, the associate pastor, the counseling minister, the worship guy, how do those folks sort of either embrace that change or process that change? And of course we see there are varying degrees of success, which I think is more, you know, true to life. I tried to write it in a realistic way, even though it's somewhat of a caricature. I wanted to acknowledge the reality that when you're leading a church through any kind of transition, and certainly the kind of transition I describe in the book, it can be very difficult to have folks who have been accustomed to one way of doing church to make that transition with you. And so some folks are just not able to do it.
So when you make the statement, which you do, that every church is a church in transition. Now, obviously, you want to start with LifePoint Church that is in transition, but you say every church is in transition. Quantify that for us a little bit. What does that mean, every church is in transition to what?
Yeah, well, just generationally, if you think about how, the core that you start with is not the core that you finish with. So correct. you will have folks who, just by virtue of getting older, the church is transitioning. And so it doesn't necessarily mean there's a gigantic, we're changing ministry philosophy kind of transition, or we're going to relocate our church to another place or something like that. Those are big transitions that churches face. We need to do, we're running out of space, so we need to do a building campaign, or we need to look for a new space, or we're actually not, we're not growing, we're in decline. So we need to think through transition of how do we work through revitalization or church merger or something like that? But then there's just the day-to-day. Every church is a church that, if we're not careful, drifts into the plateau phase or drifts into stagnation. If we don't keep our finger on the pulse, not of, you know, the message changing with the times or anything like that, but just being able to articulate, to be able to contextualize well, to translate well, and to pastor well, you know, folks who are getting older, seasons of life. And if you're, you know, routinely and regularly preaching the gospel, the kind of discipleship stages that take place within a church, that you're moving people from new believer status to more mature believer status, and helping maturing believers begin to invest in younger or newer believers as well. So there's a culture of discipleship. All of that keeps a church dynamic, or if we're not really engaging in that, we're missing out. The church is changing, and we're not keeping up in the right pastoral ways, and that usually leads to, you know, cultural breakdown within the church.
So in the book, as you describe Life Point Church, you begin to talk kind of about two models, and you emphasize at the very beginning and all the way weave it through the book, kind of the hazards of having one kind of model over the other. And I think you believe, and I would personally believe it along with you, that there is a biblical model to have, and every church has a model. And but you talk about the attractional model. And I think that's the attractional model overlaid or opposed to what we would call the multiplication model, because there is a missional multiplication model that I think is very biblical. And I think there's an attractional model that's very, very popular. So you've been around churches, you've helped pastors, you've pointed them in the direction of saying, listen, attractional model will not get biblically where and take your people where you may think that's where you want to go, and you may think that's going to get them there, and you may be reaching more and more, but it could be more and more of less and less. So describe to our leaders a little bit. When you say attraction model, I know what you mean. What does it mean to you, what you want Life Point Church to be an example of, and what does the people listening today, how do they know if they have an attractional model?
Yeah, so the attractional paradigm or attractional model is predicated, just as it sounds, that the main goal is attracting people to that ministry. That takes the centerpiece. And historically, what, you know, some of us call attractional now began with kind of the out of the church growth movement, the 1970s into the 80s. What became known early on as sort of the seeker-sensitive or seeker-targeted ministry. And I was trained for ministry. I was mentored for ministry under that model. It was a transition for us. This was a new thing coming out of, I grew up Southern Baptist. I was in SBC churches, and we were not traditional in the sense of what people might picture, overly formal and those sorts of things. We would be sort of your vanilla contemporary Baptist church, praise and worship band. I'm not an old man, Ken, but yeah. I'm old enough to remember that jarring transition when I was a kid between, you know, hymns and the organ to now having a band or having just more contemporary music. And
you're talking worship wars. That's what.
Yeah,
worship
wars. Yeah. So the worship war was somewhat settled by the time I was late high school, early college. And when I was, you know, sort of raising my flag to say, I think I'm called to ministry, the churches that, you know, the church I was a part of had then transitioned from kind of the contemporary Baptist thing into the seeker church model. They were making a transition into how do we become a church for the unchurched? And the leading practitioners at that time, the two foremost pioneers of that would be Saddleback Church in California and Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington, Illinois. And church I was a part of kind of threw in with the Willow Creek kind of model. Very similar, those two, but also somewhat distinct. And the Willow Creek model became our model. And so it was very sincere. I mean, I was all in, not just because I didn't, you know, these were the guys doing ministry. And so I wanted to learn ministry. So they were my authorities. They were my models and mentors. But I was all in because the goal was to reach lost people. There's not a, you know, exactly. is there a better goal than reaching lost people? So I thought, yeah, we do need to get rid of some of the churchy stuff and the barriers, and we need to make our churches, you know, better for lost people to come and oriented around seekers. Well, that sincere motivation eventually led, you know, gave way to a kind of not just practicality, but pragmatism, where people began to say things like, hey, we will do anything short of sin, you know, to reach lost people. And we'll do whatever it takes. And that eventually became, we'll do whatever it takes to get people in the building. And what I didn't know at the time, because I just didn't have the framework for it. And when you have people who know, you know, who are practicing telling you, this is how you do it. You just know, this is how you do it. So you combine a sincere motivation to just being a lump of clay that others can mold, which is what I was. What eventually happens is you go from, it's the mission of the church to reach lost people, to it's the point of the Sunday morning gathering. It's the point of the church to pack as many people as we can in to hear this message. And what I noticed, eventually, not at first, but what I noticed eventually is that in many of the churches I served in, and all told, I served and ministered in three of these churches in varying degrees of size. Eventually, a mega church, a seeker mega church in the Nashville area. What I noticed is that the message began to kind of take the back seat to the attraction, which is what happens when you make attraction the point. And when I began to kind of hold that up to the picture of Scripture, and you see Paul saying, things about being mindful of outsiders in your gatherings, so that you're hospitable, so that you are, articulating things, so you're not overly confusing. That's the right kind of seeker sensitive. It's not about being seeker insensitive, but understanding that the point of the Sunday service, the Sunday gathering, is not attracting as many people as possible, but proclaiming the word of Christ. And so what the attractional model eventually became, and now there's 31 flavors of it. It used to be just a couple of kinds of models. And now right. it may not even be, unchurched people necessarily that a church is trying to reach. Right. So, I mean, there may be churches that the way they reach, large amounts of people is by having a traditionalist kind of church experience that reaches, aging baby boomers who like traditionalism. And that's different than the kind of, pop music, top 40 attractionalism of my youth, but it's still attractionalism. And it's predicated on a few things, pragmatism, which is practicality turned into a formula. The Bible is very...
Stop right there. You made that statement in the book, and when I highlighted that, I was sitting there thinking, boy, I want you to explain that a little bit, because I think that's a powerful statement, that pragmatism is when you turn practicality, you said, into a formula.
Yeah.
What flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Bible is eminently practical. There are commandments. There is wisdom. There's lots of things to do. And so this is not a denial of that at all. But what pragmatism does is take what's practical or even areas of wisdom and discernment and turns them into a kind of math to say, if we do these things, we will get this result. If you put these things together, you will get this result. And so a lot of sort of the resources produced in the attractional model really made those kind of promises. This is how you get big. This is how you grow a church. If you just do these things. And a lot of folks discovered that, man, I'm doing these things, but I'm not getting these results. And what we discover in the Bible is that, it's practical, but pragmatism is antithetical to the work of the Spirit. We can plant, we can water, but it's God who gives the growth.
Right.
You're right. It removes the Holy Spirit in some ways out of the equation. If you just push these buttons, you're going to get, it's a vending machine kind of spirituality. And so the attractional model became kind of centered around a pragmatism. And because of that, also kind of a consumerism. Very famously, Bill Hybels, founder of Willow Creek, used to have a sign outside his door, which they, even would, say without any sense of, regret or irony, that said, who is our customer? What does our customer want? Very unabashedly, the idea was there's somebody we're going after that we're trying to attract, and we want to give them what they want to be able to. Well, that's pitching the church as a consumer product. That's different than hospitality. That's different than being welcoming. That's different than contextualization even, and being a blessing. That's trying to tailor what you've got towards consumer tastes. And what we know is that, very often the gospel is a stumbling block. We know that to preach the truth of Scripture is offensive to folks, even if you're doing it in a winsome and kind and gentle way, it's impossible to avoid the offense of the gospel. And so we cannot tailor our message according to consumer tastes. If we do that, we're pleasing men rather than God. So that's kind of, you know, what the attractional model is, you know, built around, consumerism and pragmatism. But that's different, brother, isn't it, than saying that our churches should be attractive, right? We believe that a gracious community that loves each other and loves their neighbor, that's really, you know, seeking to live out the faith, that is, with the Spirit's help, that's attractive, because that's different. That in itself is countercultural. You don't get that kind of thing in the world. And so we would say there's nothing wrong with being attractive. What we want to avoid is making attraction the point of what we're doing. We want to make the glory of God the point of what we're doing.
And, you know, Jared, I think as pastors, many times we are practical and we are pragmatic. And I think maybe we started and missed the first button. And if you miss that first button on the shirt, you're going to have one more button and one less hole. And I think that first button we missed was we asked the wrong question. I think we asked the question, does it work? As opposed to, is it true? Because there's a lot of things that work that may not be true. And of course, you made a comment in the book that, you know, that kind of model, attraction model, basically says, man, if it works, work it. And so there's a lot of things that work. And if working for you means bringing people in, so there's kind of a impact that happens. There's something happens when people are drawn in. But I think impact happens when people go out. And if we never teach them to go out, and we only teach them, then they become consumers, not contributors. And I think then we have a church full over the years of people who say, when the music gets better and the preacher preaching gets better, well, you guys get your game on, because this place ought to fill up, forgetting that they have a mission themselves. The church doesn't have a mission. The mission has a church. Yeah. And so what is the mission of the person sitting out there in the pew? If he's drawn in by an attraction, and I think you said it very, very well, and I'll let you just even kind of elongate this statement a little bit, but I believe you said something like, if you do not reach them, if the glory of God does not reach them by the glory of God, then the glory of God will never be able to keep them. And you may have said it in a different way, but it had all to do with not my personality, not my sermon, not my what I do as a pastor, as much as am I drawing them to me, or am I drawing them to the glory of God? How did you say that in the book?
Yeah.
That powerful.
Well, it may be the idea that what you win them with is what you win them to. You know, if you win people with. Yeah. The attraction with the bells and whistles, that's really what you've won them to. Whereas if you've won them, and they're going to expect more of that and even bigger and better of that. And that kind of takes us back, you know, Ken, you said we started not with what is true or what is the Bible, you know, prescribe, but what works. And if we even go back to that question, you know, I say a lot more about this in the Prodigal Church book, which I know is not the one we're exactly talking about, but there was data. Like, so for the longest time, these churches were getting bigger with attendance, and we could say anecdotally, hey, it obviously works, right? I mean, this is the justification. This is obviously the validation is our churches are getting bigger. People are showing up. So obviously this quote unquote works. But then, you know, 10 years, 15 years into the, you know, the model becoming more, you know, normalized and becoming the most dominant mode of church planting and others, we started to see some data on exactly, you know, who was, you know, coming to these churches, how these churches were growing. Someone like, for instance, Sally Morgenthaler, who was one of the original kind of thought leaders in right. It, you know, she came out of the Willow Creek kind of orbit, but you know, she wrote a book called Worship Evangelism, which was very influential, almost like an academic text in this a seeker-sensitive movement. And she began to do research on, you know, 10, 15 years in on how these churches are growing and who they're reaching. And what she discovered was that these churches that were predicated on being seeker driven for the unchurched actually weren't reaching majority unchurched. Certainly, they're reaching unchurched people, but the majority of the people that were constituting the growth were actually folks from smaller or other churches that were now coming to this, to this church because it had a bigger production or better programs or whatever, or people who had grown up in church and left church and were coming back. And that's a valuable constituency as well. But it's also why eventually you started hearing phrases like the de-churched and the re-churched, and because we discovered, oh, we're not really reaching the unchurched, or these churches aren't really reaching the unchurched like we thought they were. And then we even began to see data that even for the ones who could say, hey, we've got a lot of unchurched folks coming in, we began to see with the fruit of discipleship or lack thereof. So something like the Reveal survey that Willow Creek pioneered, they self-applied it and then marketed it out, packaged it out for other churches to use as a kind of self-evaluation, a very brave and honest, transparent thing to do. The church I was a part of in Nashville took place in the Reveal survey. And our results were very similar to Willow Creek's results. And I remember Bill Hybels' article in Christianity Today, where he basically said, it's not working. And I thought, well, this is it. I mean, this is going to be a sea change we're going to see. And what they discovered was they may be reaching some unchurched people, but those people were not growing by their own measurements, by the church's own measurements. We're not growing into what they called fully devoted followers of Jesus Christ. They had a discipleship deficit. And that's what a lot of these churches discovered is we may be reaching, in some part, unchurched folks. By and large, we're actually reaching church folks from other churches who don't have as good a programming as we do. That's who we're really reaching. But we're getting some unchurched folks come in, but we're actually not, they're not growing. And then those folks end up moving along. And what Sally Morgenthaler discovered is that the average tenure of a church member in the attractional churches was like 5 to 7 years. It was basically a seasonal life, season of life sort of thing. You go to one church while you have children, and then the children become youth, and maybe you find another one with the best student ministry, and then the children are gone, graduated out. And so mom and dad are like, well, we were just going to church because this is where our kids, so we're, what's right. The church that we really want? And that's all part and parcel of sort of the problem of starting with, does it work? And right. What we've seen is actually some cracks in the veneer of whether it actually works at what we set out to do. It's working at something, but I don't know that it's actually working at what we intended
it
for it to
do. I think we both know biblically, and we know to the glory of God, it's not working when we have more churches but fewer Christians.
Yes.
And then I think the other part of that, I think what you literally said is they are not, if they are not won by the glory of Christ, then they are not won to the glory of Christ. And of course, I think you and I would know, and pastors listen to this, I want you to hear Jared say this and this pastor say this. If you start with mission, you'll get worship. But now if you start with worship, you're going to get worship attenders. And which will produce worship production services, by the way. So I think maybe the thought years ago was, boy, start with exciting worship and make it attractive. And I think we went back to the Bible. Then Jared, we got a little smarter and we started realizing, Jesus built disciples knowing that it would result in a church. I think what we're trying to do is build churches hoping that will result in disciples. And we started doing the statistics and we realized, this assimilation model where you're connect, grow, serve, and you got 100%, and then you go to 50% and growing, and then you got only 25% serving. Does something seem not wrong about that? That attracting 100 and connecting, but yet you're 25% are only serving, when just the opposite of what Jesus did with 1 and then 12 and then 70 and then 120 and then 3,000, and training your members not just to be attenders, but to be multipliers, to be missionaries. And I so resonated with your book and so appreciated it, because you actually made the statement, and I'd like for you to just explain it. You said the attractional model actually decreases evangelism. I thought that's why we did the attraction model, to draw people in there. So tell us where you got that and how do you believe that? I mean, why do you believe that's the case?
Well, apart from the data that has emerged, that the churches that are, you know, centered on that idea actually aren't reaching the unchurched to the level that they think they were, I just think philosophically or practically, really, it de-incentivizes our members to evangelize, because what we tell them is just get them here and the, you know, let the experts handle it. We'll give them great music, a great production. We'll have great preaching. And what that does, sometimes explicitly, but just implicitly, is it tells the average person who lives next door to unbelievers and goes to work and school with unbelievers, who has unbelievers in their family, it tells them, oh, I actually need to put the weight of this on these people who are really, you know, gifted speakers and can, you know, put on a good production. If I can just, it turns go and tell into come and see.
Amen.
And so the building might be full of people, but that's actually not as effective and not as big a reach as if you somehow equipped and discipled and mobilized that, you know, building of people to be missionaries on in their everyday life. And so the reach would actually be further if we could somehow empower and equip our people to know how to share the gospel.
No, I totally concur with that. So as you begin to walk us through the assimilation model and then the multiplication model, you actually mentioned that I thought was very, very helpful in the book. And I don't want to do a spoiler alert here for him, but, and we won't have time, but I'd like to just kind of close out by just talking about, you talked about five metrics that matter the most. And I think those measurements are real good for us to look at, because as we're trying to reach people, and I tell people all the time, I trust your heart as a pastor. I trust your heart. I just don't trust your paradigm. And your paradigm's just, I know where it came from. And it became a great day for me personally when I began to understand that, Jared, that people did not come to Idyllwild and they didn't come to our church for an experience. They came for an encounter. And you cannot have an encounter without the Holy Spirit of God. You can have a show and you can have some great production and you may think you have, but I'm telling you, people know when God shows up. They may not know what he looks like, but they just know when he's in the room. Yeah. And pastors know it as well. But you kind of flipped a switch a little bit here for us and said, no, wait a minute, pastors, as opposed to counting nickels and noses, and you need to do that, and that's okay, and that's important. You didn't downplay that. But you said, man, there's some metrics and some measurements to know. Are we doing and do we have that missional multiplication model? Let me just hit them, and then you talk about them real quick. Okay. How about this one? A growing esteem for Jesus Christ.
Yeah, well, if Jesus is the center of our church, if he's the center of the universe, if he upholds the universe by the word of his power, then we would hope that one of the signs of a church that's truly growing in the way that really matters, that ultimately matters, that we would see a magnification of Christ as a dominant value, that Jesus would not be a sort of a supporting character or a cameo star or as a life coach or something, you know, but he would be the center of our lives. So what we want to see is discernibly that there is a growing esteem for Christ in our church culture.
And I think every pastor listening to this knows when we've done it well and when we haven't done it well. At the end of our message, were they talking about our message? Or were they talking about us? Hmm. Or were they talking about him? And I think it becomes obvious that when you made it about Jesus, it becomes about Jesus. How about this one? Discernible spirit of repentance. In other words, trading sin avoidance for works righteousness. You talked about how do we do that? How do we trade that sin avoidance for works righteousness?
Well, it's an embrace of humility, which sometimes cuts against or is opposed to the idea of putting on the best version of ourselves. If I'm caught up as a pastor or worship leader in putting on a production that is impressive, that is attractive, I will begin to downplay my fault, you know, faults and failings at least as they really are. So, you know, I might could repackage and spin them in some way that makes me still end up looking better. But if there's a spirit of confession, if there's a spirit of taking sin seriously, that our major problem is not that, you know, I need a leg up. I need my felt needs, you know, comforted. And those are good things. The Bible speaks to those things. But my fundamental problem is that I fall short of the glory of God. And if I will acknowledge that humbly, and if I will acknowledge that honestly, then we can begin to see people who really embrace the gospel as the solution to what actually ails us. And we'll see, you know, the biblical practice of church discipline on one hand, but also just an air of humility rather than an air of sort of pomposity or pride in our church culture.
Well, all of these metrics are so good. You talked about a dog devotion to the word. You talked about being interested in theology and doctrine. And then, of course, I love this one, that your church is known, that it's evident that it has a love not only for God, but a love for its neighbors. Jared, there is so much in this book that we literally could spend an hour talking about. I just want to personally, on behalf of Southern Baptists and behalf of pastors, I want to say thank you. Thank you for articulating it and writing it in a way that I think challenged every one of us, seasoned and even those just getting in ministry. We could talk about authenticity. We could talk about how a younger generation sees it. We could get into those worship wars, or at least music, and how what does a generation look at and think that music is authentic. And I just want to say to you, pastors, our time's running out, but it's all in the book, The Gospel-Driven Church. Jared, if you had one word that you would probably say, this is probably what makes me, if you cut Jared Wilson, he bleed. This is what I would say to pastors. I am a pastor. I love writing to pastors. I like being a pastor. I like to motivate the pastors. What would you say to a pastor today that would encourage him, but maybe even challenge him? And I'll give you the last word here, sir.
Wow. One thing, you know, brother, I have made my life in ministry over the last 15 years or so about exalting the good news of Jesus Christ. And in my estimation, that is not just the means of reaching the lost. Like, you don't have to trade in your sincere desire to reach lost people. And if you're gospel centered, they're going to hear the good news, because you'll be given the good news as often as possible. But because the gospel also is the means by which believers are matured, they grow in sanctification. 1 Corinthians 15, Philippians 2, Titus 2, 2 Corinthians 3, all of these are good texts to help us see that the gospel is not just for the unbeliever, but for the believer as well. So I think my final sort of exhortation would be what I've kind of made the theme of my life, which is that the gospel is big enough, strong enough, versatile enough, multifaceted enough to do what the Lord has called us to do. So we can resolve, like Paul in 1 Corinthians 2:2, we can resolve to know nothing among them except Christ and Him crucified.
Couldn't have said it any better. Well, pastors, thank you for listening to the Equipping Pastors podcast. And if this podcast has been helpful to you, and well, I hope it has, could you give us a rating, give us a review? Because your feedback, it helps other pastors find this podcast. And if you'd like to be notified of when the next episode is released, just subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. I hope you've heard not only from our guest today, but you've heard from the Lord that the answer to church growth and health, pastor, is not better methodology. It's actually really a more true and a truer identity, because identity precedes all your activity. I couldn't recommend the book, The Gospel-Driven Church, enough. I believe it is current for its day, current for its time. And pastor, I hope you'll listen to it, because most of us, I think we have a functional mission statement in our church. I think that functional Great Commission today almost says this: go ye into all the world, make more worship attenders, baptizing them in the name of small groups, and teaching them to serve a few more hours a month. I hope that's not your mission statement. He told us to go and to make disciples. Jared Wilson, thank you today for being with us. Thank you for helping us and writing to us. and being with us. And Pastor, let me just say this to you. Hang in there. We say at NAM all the time, you are our number one customer. And by the way, we at North American Mission Board are your biggest fan. Hey, I'm Ken Whitten. You have a Jesus-filled day.
You've been listening to Equipping Pastors with Ken Whitten, a podcast powered by the North American Mission Board. If you like what you heard, take a few minutes to rate and review us, or share this episode with a friend. It's the best way to help other pastors find this podcast. To find more resources to engage, equip, and encourage you as a pastor, visit EquippingPastorsPodcast.com.